No pressure. I'm going to make more. We didn't know what kind of crab we were making.
So, good evening, everybody. This is great. What a big turnout. I love it. My name is Meg Mott. I teach politics at Marlborough College. I teach a very special form of politics, political theory, which means that I don't have to read lots of books because there aren't that many political theorists around. I find this very helpful, especially as I age. Certainly, feminists have added some new political theory, and critical race scholars have added some new political theory. But really, I don't have to spend that much attention because I got my solid guys. And so tonight, the solid guys, Machiavelli. I highly recommend this book, The Prince. He always illuminates the real condition of human beings. It may not be pleasant, but we're fairly predictable. And the other person I'll be using tonight is James Madison, one of the brains behind the Federalist Papers. And if you're interested in the Constitution, which we'll be talking about this summer, we did the First Amendment. We just did it last month. And this month we're going to do the Second Amendment. We're skipping the Third Amendment next month because anybody know what the Third Amendment is?
The quartering of troops.
All right, exactly. The quartering of troops.
And that's why we have a Second Amendment.
So, and we'll see about that. I mean, we do have a Second Amendment. But the Third Amendment, because it's about the quartering of troops, we're actually going to skip it. I hope I don't have too many disappointed people. And we're going to pick it up with the Fourth Amendment, which is about privacy. So that's going to be in August, the last Wednesday in August. But before we begin, the idea behind these series at the library is that too often in the United States, the only people who are really engaged in deliberation are Supreme Court justices. When, in fact, we should all be deliberating. And when I mean deliberating, I mean arguing about what it means to live in a constitutional democracy.
All right.
So that we get to hear all different viewpoints, and we begin to think about what's at stake in living in a constitutional democracy, because that's a different kind of democracy than other kinds. It means that we have this thing called the Constitution. Oh, look, another nice thing about my line of work. In this country, it's very short. It doesn't take that long to read it. It's well worth reading. It's kind of amazing how long it's lasted. And it's something that people like James Madison certainly intended for us to deliberate and to think about and to know it. Not that everybody, when they created the Constitution, had the exact same idea about what it was, but that it began a deliberation about a document. So, we talked about, in our last session in June, about deliberation. So, this is something that came up last time. Why do we deliberate our rights? Because it promotes legitimacy of collective decision-making. And certainly in the United States, not all our collective decision-making has received legitimacy just because the Supreme Court did it, right? For the most part, the Supreme Court makes a ruling and everybody says, yeah, that's right, okay. But oftentimes, more often than maybe we're aware of, the Supreme Court will make a decision and people will say, wait a minute, that wasn't right. We talked about last time, I think somebody mentioned Dred Scott, right? So the Dred Scott decision that happened, I think that was 1858? Four? It's definitely in the 1850s. That was a decision that said African Americans had no citizenship, and so it took the 14th Amendment to turn that ruling over. We have other contentious Supreme Court decisions. In our lifetime, probably one of the more contentious is Roe v. Wade. And the idea is that by deliberating, we get to think more as a community about what does it mean to live in a constitutional democracy. We begin to think about what's at stake in this and what matters, And we're not all going to agree. That's why we live in a constitutional democracy, as opposed to a tyranny. Because we could all agree, and that would just be because I told you what to think, if I made myself tyrant. So this deliberation, what we're doing tonight, is a way of promoting the legitimacy of a collective decision. We're not going to get to the bottom of the Second Amendment, but this is where we would move if we stopped relying so heavily on the Supreme Court. The other benefit of having a conversation about a constitutional amendment is that it encourages public-spirited perspectives on public issues, lots of P's in that. So we get to hear different points of view, and that's a good thing, especially in these days where people tend to only talk to people they agree with. So you want to deliberate because you actually want to get different points of view out there. The other lovely thing about deliberation is it promotes mutually respectful processes of decision making. So we're not, I'm sure, in our short time we have together this evening, we're not going to be able to solve the big issues around the Second Amendment and how it should be interpreted, but we're beginning a process where, you know, the fact is that we can have this conversation and have disagreement and think about why we may have strong disagreements in the United States about the Second Amendment, because I don't think that's just haphazard. I think it's one of those things we have to wrestle with, that we might have a little bit more respect, not only for each other, but for our capacity to actually deliberate. And finally, we deliberate in order to correct mistakes. The Supreme Court justices make mistakes, and all political bodies make mistakes. So we are able to develop the habits of thinking about things in really big ways and wrestle with this stuff, then maybe we'll be able to correct some of the mistakes of the past. So it's a very, in some ways, idealistic picture of what human beings are capable of. So I did bring in Machiavelli to make sure that we stay real. But I do think, and I think we see this in town meeting, even when we lose on a proposition, I always feel better for having had the conversation. So this is operating in that spirit. So something that we didn't talk about last time, those are the four reasons why we deliberate. What does it take to engage in a good deliberation? Here's a little picture from a town meeting. Not ours, but somebody's in Vermont. That when somebody gives their perspective, they provide reasons. Not because I think so, or not because that's the way it's always been done, although that could be a reason, but because you've come to an idea and you want to explain to other people how you came to that idea. So there's a really important piece to deliberation is people give reasons, which doesn't always happen again in political speech, where it's just, I'm right, you're wrong. Accessible information must be provided. So today, in our discussion about the Second Amendment, I'm not giving you any facts and figures, I'm giving you political theory. And I'm hoping to get some political theory from all of you. So what we're doing is wrestling with the major question of, why do we have a Second Amendment in our Constitution? What is it serving about human beings in general? The American scheme of justice in particular, I'm gonna get some ideas on what that might mean. And that information, so the information I'm providing you this evening, it's definitely philosophical. It's not factual. And that's just as a way of thinking about, we're gonna have a big idea then about constitutional issues, let's talk about big principles to help us do that. And that the decision endures. Okay, we're not gonna take a vote tonight. In town meeting, we take votes. Supreme Court justices, they take votes. But there's nothing to say that if a community comes together and begins to decide what does the Second Amendment mean for us, that there's a sense that it might endure. That isn't to say it lasts forever, right? Because you got to correct mistakes. So it's, and we talked about this last time in terms of when you're deliberating, are you just deliberating in the moment, or are you deliberating thinking that it's actually going to mean something for a while. And finally, that the process is dynamic. And this is so important. Everybody decides for a moment, I don't even know where I'm going to stand on this. In 45 minutes from now, I don't even know what position I'm going to take. After a little Machiavelli, maybe you will think differently. After a little James Madison, Maybe you'll say, oh, I hadn't thought about that. With the little Black Panthers even, I did throw them in. You might have a different, slightly different idea about this. So that the process is dynamic. Not only do you think you might change somebody else's opinion, you begin to think that your own opinion might change. Whoa! That's why politics is so great, right? People are changing all over the place. So we're doing this activity, I'm not going to say against or in spite of, perhaps alongside of. But my main concern about what happens in a constitutional democracy right now in the 21st century is most decisions are made by the elites or in such legalistic language that ordinary people don't really have a clue what's going on. And so we're trying to draw that down, which means we may use some legalistic language, but the only big term is incorporation. So we'll go into something in a little bit more detail, but I'm just going to throw that balloon out right now. Incorporation is an interesting legal term, and when we actually get into it, maybe because there's a little mind share right now for that term, you'll say, oh yeah, okay, I know incorporation, she already mentioned it. Because that's going to be the hard part of the discussion this evening. Okay, so before we get started, what is the American scheme of justice? Anybody?
I'll even take down a little note here. But what do you think? The American scheme of justice. What does this mean? Laura?
Well, I would just jump to innocent until proven guilty.
Okay. Presumption of innocence?
Yeah.
Can people see this?
Yeah.
Try to write big. Something else. American scheme of justice. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, sir.
Okay. We are allowed a trial by our peers.
Trial by peers. And if anybody wants me to know their name for future reference, I know.
Ed Cutler.
Ed?
Yeah.
And if I put it in my fingers and I remember, Ed. Okay. Trial by peers. Yes. Okay. Other parts. American scheme of justice. Greg.
We have the right to face those who charge us or accuse us of a crime.
Face our accusers. Yeah.
Right, not to
ourselves. Ah, no self-incrimination. These are all in the Bill of Rights, right? I mean,
yes.
We're really hitting key aspects of our Bills of Rights. Bill of Rights. So, no self-incrimination. Anything else? I mean, we got a lot of criminal stuff here, a lot of jury stuff here, but maybe because this is justice. Anybody other? A speedy trial, right, to a speedy trial.
Cruel and unusual punishment.
Cruel and unusual punishment. You know which amendment that is?
The eighth.
Eighth, awesome. See, somebody's reading these things. So far, we're getting everything cruel and unusual.
Right to representation?
Yes, right? Right to representation, even though that has nothing to do with the trial, necessarily, right? Mm-hmm. Right to representation. What is that?
Lawyer,
and what else?
Double jeopardy.
Well, we're saying it's so interesting. We're very much in the criminal. American scheme of justice could even be bigger than a criminal justice system. Could even be bigger than civil suits. Could even not involve lawyers. Because right to representation, that's not a legal issue necessarily. That's also American scheme of justice. You should have a representative. Do we agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's pretty fundamental. Anything else?
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech, which we talked about last time.
This gentleman mentioned double jeopardy.
Double jeopardy. And, oh, and that's an interesting one.
Not really.
I mean,
because the British were the ones that kept issuing warrants until they arrested people finally and put them on trial.
Does anybody notice, does the word double jeopardy actually appear? Is that one of those promises that's not actually there? You can tell me I'm wrong, because I have a short...
It's in the Constitution.
Yeah?
What is double jeopardy?
So double jeopardy is... You want to explain?
If you're acquitted of murder and they find out the next day you did it, if you were already acquitted, they can't retry you.
Right.
Without more information.
Yeah.
Okay, the one little piece I would caution everybody before you get too excited about double jeopardy is if you're charged by the state for a crime, does that mean the federal government can't charge you?
That's the state.
It's different.
You can be charged.
So even though there is this thing called double jeopardy, that doesn't stop. If you're charged by the state, it won't stop the feds. So that's a clue for the thing I'm fishing for. A very important part of the American scheme of justice. Yeah, John?
Incorporation.
You say it?
No, never mind. I thought it was the magic word, incorporation.
Oh, incorporation. Well, it's okay. States' rights, yes. An American scheme of justice is a federalist system, which means it's very interesting, almost approaching transubstantiation. That I can be in Vermont and in the United States at the exact same time. Right?
Yes.
There are two political entities that I participate at the exact same time, and we don't even get any feedback from that doubleness. It's just happening. So federalism is a key piece to the American scheme of justice. So I have to write that one down.
But other than that, these are great.
So let's get to the Second Amendment.
Which protects all those.
Which the Second Amendment. Does somebody wish to read the script in italics? Yeah, go ahead.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Yeah, this is a very special amendment. First of all, it doesn't look anything like the First Amendment, which begins Congress. Congress shall not. Most of these amendments are constraints, or they're understood as constraints on the federal government. The only reason that we could get a constitution passed, well, is because people understood that the new government, the national government, was not going to be enormous. So always with the United States, there's been this tension that the states were going to be able to hold back any kind of behemoth known as Washington, D.C., although it wasn't Washington in the beginning. So normally, there's this understanding that these amendments are talking right to the national government, the federal government, and saying, But this amendment, it's kind of poetic. And a lot of the confusion, and I think I can say that, because there's been a lot of confusion about this, is who is it talking to? What is its purpose? A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, if you were an English teacher, you might say that is a prefatory clause, which means it sets the scope of the discussion, and then what follows could fit within the prefatory clause. Yeah, hand in the back.
You're wrong on both counts. Wrong. The reason of the second was to recognize a right that existed before the American government was established. And it was more to do with the fact that we have a right to defend ourselves. It does not mention guns, it mentions arms. Arms can mean a whole lot of things.
So you're giving us the second interpretation. So I'm showing two different interpretations. The first, and I'm going to push this through, and then I'm sure we're going to have differences of opinions, which is great. So one way of understanding this is that the beginning clause is the governing clause. So I want to just show you what that interpretation looks like. This has been the historical interpretation of the Second Amendment. Controlling preface means collective right. So the right to bear arms is understood as a collective right. And that has been understood as the state organizes a militia, such as the National Guard. And that's what that looks like. So that has been, and I'm going to keep going, and then I'm really excited to hear what you guys have to say. So that has been a historical interpretation. There is, though, another interpretation out there, and that's the second one we're going to look at. And in this interpretation, what matters most is the operating clause, which is the right to bear arms. So in the operating clause interpretation, the right is individual. And this is where there's been the big disagreement. Mm. Is the right collective? Therefore, it is a right that states have to organize militia. Or is the right individual, in which case individuals organize themselves outside of the purview of the state? And those are the two interpretations that are running in the Second Amendment. Although, I'm going to tell you, before 2001, we primarily had the first, not the second. So we'll look at how it started to shift. But here's a picture of what an individual right looks like. So those are individuals organizing themselves, not through the state. And there's arguments for both sides within the Second Amendment. So can you see, just with the language we have, the actual text, there's the possibility of two ways of reading it, and that the collective right was the dominant interpretation up until 2001. So let's look at what happened in 2001. This is a case, United States v. Emerson. It did not go to the Supreme Court. This is a federal appeals court decision. And the Fifth Circuit ruled that the Second Amendment confers an individual right to keep and bear arms. So the first time this language gets way up the federal system is in 2001, and it's right after 9/11. Is that significant? I don't know. It was a significant moment in the United States. And especially when, as we're talking about gun rights and thinking about arms, it's always, always about defense. So the nation was attacked for the second time, unless you count those 1812 wars, where Canada and the United States or some of those other wars, but it was the second time the nation was attacked. And not that this case came before 2000, 9/11, but the ruling came after 9/11. But that's a Fifth Circuit. It's not a Supreme Court.
But the Supreme Court decided in two cases, McDonald versus Chicago.
Yeah, so I'm going to get there. You're way ahead. You're on my screen number five already. Can you just let me know what your name is?
Jim Lyers.
Jim, thank you. Yeah, so you got this down, exactly. There's going to be some big Supreme Court decisions that change all this. But I want us to just hang out at what some people call an inflection point, where it changes. So at the time in 2001, the Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal. Okay, but John Ashcroft, maybe you all remember John Ashcroft? He wrote, and this is, I don't know, is it unusual? It's significant that after this Fifth Circuit ruling, John Ashcroft writes a memo, "The Second Amendment more broadly protects the rights of individuals, including persons who are not members of any militia or engaged in active military service or training, to possess and bear their own firearms subject to reasonable restrictions designed to prevent criminal misuse." So if the earlier interpretation in many people's minds understood the Second Amendment as being funneled through the states and their militias, John Ashcroft made it very clear that in fact you did not need to be part of a militia in order to bear arms. He says it's the United States General. It's more like the United States is the executive branch.
What authority does he have to make that statement? As Attorney General?
Is it law at that point in the same way as Supreme Court? No. Is it indicating that the executive branch is interested in that interpretation? And remember, we're talking about interpretation, which means it's not the law saying something specific. It's the law being read two different ways. Mm. Nobody's changing the law. The law has always had some confusion about it.
because it does not say Congress shall not. It says two different things. And sometimes people read it as the first controls the second, and sometimes people read it as the second controls the first. And that's pretty much, you know, what started happening in 2001. So is it okay, Jim, is it okay? I'm just going to keep going just a little bit further, and then I'd love to hear more. Okay, so John Ashcroft. So at the time this happened in 2001, lawyers like at the University of Chicago were saying, not to worry. Let me take a look at the law. This isn't going to happen, they said, in 2001. It's not going to be that what Ashcroft says. It can't be. Because the First Amendment does not follow the rules of incorporation. We can take certain fundamental rights and make them apply to the states, but we can't take all the Bill of Rights and make it apply to the states. So I want to talk a little bit about what this means. Gaining individual rights through selective incorporation. The Bill of Rights, those first 8, 9, 10, were written to constrain the national government, not the states. However, eventually people said, what do you mean? The states can deny, let's look at what we got on the list.
Can Vermont deny the presumption of innocence? No. Can Vermont deny freedom of speech? No. All of these, trial by peers. So it took a while for these cases to come up.
And they were only able to do this, to take what was applied just to the national government and make it apply to the states. Once we got the 14th Amendment and it had this due process clause, people began to bring cases forward to the Supreme Court to say, hey, free speech, that is not just a right for U.S. citizens. That's a right that the state government needs to slow down on.
Well, what about the 10th Amendment?
Even the 10th Amendment.
The 10th Amendment says that anything not enumerated in the Constitution automatically reverts to the states and the people.
Right, right.
So all that other stuff is already enumerated in the Constitution.
And that could be an interpretation before the 14th Amendment. So,
no interpretation.
So what the piece is that you can, like, right, you pick up this Constitution and you can say, these rights are pretty clear, and we know how to apply them. And especially with something like the 10th Amendment that applies to the states. However, the way it works is that eventually this comes to be a matter of case law. So I'm going to keep pushing through, and then, well, because I know there's other people who are going to want to participate. So the Bill of Rights constrains the national government, not the states. However, that doesn't mean that it couldn't constrain the states. And the way lawyers did this was through the 14th Amendment, through the Due Process Clause. The incorporation of fundamental rights, and one of the court's cases decided, those rights that are fundamental to the American scheme of justice. How are we going to know which one applies? If it's, because it turns out some of those, like a right to a grand jury, that never got applied to the states. So some things got applied because they were understood to be fundamental. When it's a fundamental right to the American scheme of justice, and I think everybody agrees to all of these, then it gets applied, or it has been applied. So this one is a 1968 case. Duncan incorporated the right to a jury trial as a fundamental principle of liberty and justice. But it takes a case, goes to the Supreme Court, and a very specific right that's listed in the Bill of Rights then gets incorporated, that's the term they use, to the states. So here's the big question, where we get to the real issue. Are gun rights fundamental to the American scheme of justice? Well, let's see what James Madison says, because he's going to be one of those people who helps us understand what does it mean, the American scheme of justice. And the thing that's so great by opening this up a little bit Because right now we have a controversy that has fairly strong lines. I love political theory because the idea is we could open up that a little bit and get more oxygen in the room. That's the hope, always to get a little more oxygen. So let's see what James Madison has to say about gun rights. And this is a long passage, I have to break it up. Somebody want to read the first half of the sentence?
Sure. Hey. Besides the advantage of being armed, is this the first half? Which the Americans possess over the people of almost every other nation.
Yeah, okay, so here's James Madison saying, the United States is able to be a place of liberty because everybody's armed. And that the Americans are more armed than any of their European peers. Why? Kings don't let their subjects be armed. So he starts with this, and it looks like, wow, okay, so we're going to make sure that everybody has a lot of guns. They all have a lot of guns. Because there's a real advantage. You can't have a democracy, says James Madison, unless you've got a well-armed population. But then let's keep looking at what kind of armed. Somebody want to read the second one?
The existence of subordinate governments to which people are attached and by which the militia officers are appointed forms a barrier against the enterprises of an ambitious federal government.
And that is how he spells enterprises, I just want you to know. Okay, so is he saying individual right or is he saying collective right? A collective right is an organized militia.
Collective.
Collective. Why do you think he's saying collective? Yeah, go ahead.
I would still say it's an individual right because of the Militia Act. Uh-huh. There was organized and unorganized militias at the time. Uh-huh. Our own state constitution, any person can form militia where we actually vote for officers up to, I think, colonel. So there could be half a dozen people here who decide to form one, and it'd be not subject to any federal regulation.
Right. So it could be this one statement. It could be. It looks like it's going to the militias. Because look at this: the existence of subordinate governments. Madison is very concerned that there are subordinate governments and it's not just one big government. So on that hand, it could be collective, but on the same token, because in the beginning, it's like it's better to have an armed population.
But
But
getting back to the Third Amendment, the quartering of troops, the Founding Fathers did not want a standing army in the United States.
Yeah, and can
and
we hold
Mason
on?
Considered all citizens the militia, all right? They were, all the citizens were the militia, he said, except for a few public officials.
So just because of the first principle of deliberation, we're going to work right now with the material on the screen. That's my play, my fast card.
Yes, Jim?
Yeah.
I'd like to make a special request. For many of us, these ideas are not as well organized as they are in your consciousness. So we need to hear the ideas being presented and then engage in the deliberation and the discussion respectfully.
Yeah. Thank you. So just for purposes of now, to hold on to what we've got here and to keep working with the text we have in front of us. And then we'll keep working on it. And it sounds like there's, you know, could be more of these conversations, and moving to the third might make sense. I'm moving to the fourth next month, but moving to the third another time. So for purposes of now, I'm going to be more militant. I'm going to hold us to our text here.
According to the text, back it up so I can see it again.
Let me make it go back.
Thanks.
Yeah. Oh no.
Uh-oh.
I'm not as good at this as I was. Okay. I mean, maybe I don't look very good.
So looking at this, which came first, the subordinate governments or the people that were armed?
Right, and that would be an interesting piece, like to start to look at this.
Right.
It's a chicken and the egg to a certain degree, or it's the, you know, how, and this is why individual rights, collective rights, what comes first?
Would it be a subordinate government if the people weren't armed?
Right.
And who would arm them?
And so let me just throw some federalism in here. For our next slide. So this, generally, when people say federalism, this is what it looks like. And can you tell us your name, I'm sorry?
Bob.
Okay, Bob. There's something missing on this slide of this picture of federalism. Maybe you all have seen this picture of federalism. What's missing, Bob? Because you were just talking about this.
I see states, I see national government, but I don't see individuals.
You don't see individuals, exactly, right. This is oftentimes, though, how we understand the federalist system, is that it was designed in order to have tension between the states and the national government. And it's that balance, that checks and balances, that makes us less susceptible to tyranny. However, as Bob points out, where do the individuals fit here? In much of what Madison writes, the individuals fit in the states, because that's their first love, because they allow them to have militias. This is Madison's reasoning. You want to get devotion in the states, arm your people, and then you'll have much more devotion to your states than you will to the federal government. And another reason how we, and I'm going to keep pushing on this a little bit more. Did you want something about this slide? Yeah.
When they wrote the Constitution, mm-hmm. states were supposed to have more power than the federal government.
Right.
That's why they are all called sovereign states. Mm-hmm. Any time any state in this union is supposed to be able to tell the federal government to take a hike.
And this was the argument Madison made. To try, and most of his arguments are like, don't worry about the federal government, because the states are awesome, and we can balance that. There was a hand right behind you.
Yes, this gets to the point of where the power gets beyond the individual person. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning of the Constitution, it equated the individual person mm-hmm. as having the right of speech and the right to bear arms, equating freedom of speech and the right to bear arms, which actually is that way for a reason, and that is to protect the freedom of speech. And, so that he has right. an individual power mm-hmm. to always be able to speak and disagree with his own government.
So, and what we're hearing right now, these are all the really strong arguments for the individual rights interpretation. And thank you, actually, I'm appreciating this, because we're getting a more robust understanding of what the individual right interpretation looks like, and how it's not irrational, it's making all these points between what's happening historically and what's happening with the other one. John?
The states are to keep the federal government in check.
Right.
Isn't it the individuals within those states to keep the state in check?
That would be another argument for individual rights. Yeah, so I'm going to keep pushing this a little bit in terms of what some other ways of thinking about this.
The people created the states. The states created the federal government. The federal government didn't create the states. So really, the states have the power of nullification. They could vote to nullify any rule or law that the federal government tries to.
Okay, I didn't put nullification out there, so I'm going to have to run this one back. Oh, we're moving into nullification. We can do another one on nullification. We're going to stick with incorporation. So I want to stay with this idea of arming and how important arming is. And I'm going to stick with James Madison for a moment. We kind of made this point. European governments are afraid to trust the people with arms. So if you want the people to trust you, you should arm them. However, he also says, this is what I'm trying to get at. There's an interesting little, even within one author, one amendment, there's some interesting tensions. One author, interesting tensions. If there were smaller governments with militias, it may be affirmed with the greatest assurance that the throne of every tyranny in Europe would be speedily overturned. And in this passage, he's not talking about non-state organized. He's talking about states that are very organized. So there we have that thing. Is it collective or is it individual? So let's bring in another political theorist, one of my favorites, Machiavelli, who also makes a similar claim about human beings, about arming and trust. Somebody want to read this one?
Sure. Okay. By arming your subjects, you arm yourself. Those who were suspect become loyal, and those who were loyal are changed from being your subjects to being your partisans.
Now, we have to understand with Machiavelli, he always understands human nature very well. It's not necessarily he's talking about American scheme of justice or justice. He's talking about human nature. So, it's not a good idea to, go to the next one, but it's a very good idea to arm people if you want their loyalty. In fact, it's going to be a very quick way of gaining loyalty. Arm them, and they'll like you, because you won't be a subject anymore, you'll be their partisan. And then, he says, this other very wise thing. Somebody want to read this one? Yeah, Mary.
As soon as you disarm your subjects, you start to offend them, showing whether through cowardice or suspicion that you mistrust them. On either score, hatred is aroused against you.
Yeah, so very bad idea to disarm your subjects. Don't do it. Because why would you do it? Because you're afraid of them? That doesn't look good. Or is it because you're suspicious? That's not good either. So the whole question about arming and the relationship between citizens and the government has been understood to be really, really deep. There's a reason why this gets people agitated. And so let's look at, what have I got? Arming and justice. Let's look at a little more recent. Okay, we can get out of James Madison, where we saw, at least in the United States, a really clear picture where arming may have gotten some justice. So first we'll get a little passage from Machiavelli. Probably one of his most famous. Michael, do you want to read this one?
All armed prophets have conquered, and unarmed prophets have come to grief.
Right. And so we can look at Black Panthers. Certainly they made a big statement. I remember when they came to New Haven, Connecticut, and everybody I knew was all of a sudden very quiet, the white people, very quiet and well-behaved. There was nothing like that show of force. There was also the National Guard. That was also a little quieting as well. But I remember thinking, man, look at that. So this was a place where being armed, you know, and say this was a group of people who were not operating through a state militia. They had armed themselves, and they were arming themselves outside of any state in order to get justice. And here's another picture, and it's not a very pleasant picture, but it, to me, really captures this notion of how, powerless a person can feel without their arms. So here's another picture of the Black Panthers. And there's a police raid in Philadelphia in 1970. Very different picture. One's armed, one's not armed. Yeah.
The problem with the Black Panthers, though, to use them in this, it's not right, because they were terroristic. They're not normal, everyday, run-of-the-mill Joes that want their guns to protect themselves and their families, or to hunt with, or whatever. They were bombing places. There was a lot of terrorism going on. But so I don't feel bad for them for this, because this
so
is...
So just, can you, just in terms of, like, again, we're trying to work with, what is the difference between, I'll go back, because this one, let's go back to this one. This is a group of people who are armed, who are not armed through the state. So they were using their individual rights. So this is what individual, so you may have disagreements with their tactic, and others may have disagreements with other tactics, but just in terms of those categories that we've been talking about, who gets to be armed, this is a group that was armed, that did not become armed through either the state or the national government. So just in terms of, like, thinking of three different groups, and through the right of individual rights, so I hear what you're saying, but through the right of individual rights, this is what they were able to do. And I've got a hand up.
Well, I want to put out that, in fact, the Black Panthers set up food shelves, they set up daycare centers, and so there's an incredible amount of misinformation about the Black Panthers.
So did the Hells Angels, but it doesn't.
Wait, I'm talking. Mm-hmm. So to make that generalization, I would encourage all of us to do more research about the Black Panthers, and it certainly come out to show that it was a lot of exploitation, manipulation, to make it appear that this was what was happening. Mm-hmm. And so I would encourage you to do more research rather than making that generalization, all of us, because I feel that it's inappropriate to make that kind of statement in this mm-hmm. setting.
So I've got two hands up, and you had your hand up longer.
I'd like to build on what this individual mentioned. If the militia, state's militia is the National Guard, and the National Guard is called out, it's a declaration of martial law. What happens to our rights when that happens?
Right. And so
the Black Panthers mm-hmm. were a result of that during the riots through the mid-60s into the 70s.
So I want to make sure I'm understanding that, because one could argue that these armed prophets, so if you're a member or you had some sympathy for the situation for African Americans, you could say these armed prophets, they looked like they were going to conquer, but in fact, enormous state power was directed upon them. So the armed prophets may have come to grief. So I don't know if that's where you wanted to go, but there's
What I was going is that with the state militia, which is the National Guard, when the National Guard is called out,
mm-hmm.
martial law is declared.
Right.
And a lot of our rights
go away.
Exactly.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And if you were to talk to some of these people, they might say, whoa, we had our individual rights, because the Black Panthers were armed on the streets and the cops recognized it as legitimate. And then they started passing some drug laws, and if you remember, Ashcroft says, if it's for criminal, then you can take the gun rights away. So that has been an effective tactic. If you're wanting to arm yourself against the state, you better be quite nervous about drug laws and other sorts of things. Because whether or not there's martial law, there's many ways that people's guns get taken away, and it's often through the criminal justice system. So you could have martial law in which they take taken away on the big level, but even on the individual level, they start getting taken away. Yeah.
And I'm hesitant to hear the word terrorist when we're talking about a rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is a term that's going to be, again, very subjective. Depending on where you're at, you might say, oh, those people should have guns, these people shouldn't have guns. And the minute it becomes an individual right, then it's like, okay, who's deciding who can and who can't have guns? Terrorism becomes a way to do that. That's but for right. the most part, people's guns get taken away because of criminal. And yes. There's 75 million people in this country with criminal records, so that's a fairly big part of the population that loses a lot of rights all the time. Thanks for reading.
There's a lot of organizations that are not, you know, in the right, such as the Hells Angels, who have done very similar things. They do Toys for Tots, they do a lot of stuff like that. It doesn't make it right to bomb something. That's where I was coming from. If this isn't an individual right thing, mm-hmm. this is an organization that came together, and they have a right to be armed, yes, if they, mm-hmm. if, mm-hmm. however, how they went about what they did wasn't right, is what I was trying to mm-hmm. get across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we could see, like, different things. There's certainly things the Black Panthers did, I'm like, oh my God, what were you thinking, right?
Yeah.
There's other things. I mean, the reason they were in New Haven was because of the murder and torture of Alex Rackley, I think was his name. Anyway, nobody's perfect, right? Let's go back to Machiavelli. Nobody's perfect. But this business about being armed, and if you feel like you're a prophet, maybe you do need arms. Because unarmed prophets come to grief. By the same token, armed prophets are coming to grief too. So that's the piece I'm sort of like holding out there, is that what is the output of all these arms? Yes, we've got our rights, but what's happening? So for the Black Panthers, it definitely did not go down well. So one of the things that we would want to be deliberating is our individual gun rights fundamental. Yeah, Angie.
So who was Machiavelli talking about? Because I feel like in our recent history, we've seen unarmed prophets who have had huge impact, and also armed prophets who have had huge impact.
Mm.
And so does that, I mean, why, where does that statement even fall now for us? And what, who was he talking about? Like, was he talking about Jesus, or, I don't know, who was he talking about?
He was talking about this guy named Savonarola?
Savonarola.
Thank you. Who was an unarmed prophet and was eventually taken out. He's the one for the bonfire of the vanities.
Yeah.
Who wanted to make the Florentines pure by having them not indulge in vices. So he's rather, I don't know, conservative religious leader who had a big, big following, but eventually met with a bad end. And so, I mean, that's a little Florentine politics, but Machiavelli looked at that and said, better to be an armed prophet than an unarmed prophet. And that's hard because, and I throw Machiavelli in, not because he's necessarily right, but because he's gonna like sort of open up some of these questions. And some people say, well, Martin Luther King, was he an unarmed prophet? Yeah. Well, did he have a handgun? Yeah. He carried a handgun. And what, and so, as you said, what good did it do him? So there's this question of like, you know, like violence, is this going to be fundamental? And is it fundamental in a way that serves us? My guess is the idea of our individual gun rights fundamental, we're going to have different viewpoints in this room. Some people feel that it's very strongly fundamental. And what I'm going to suggest, before we go to the next question, I'd love to hear, this is almost like a moment, right? Could somebody make an argument for why an individual gun right is fundamental in such a way that you might persuade somebody who doesn't agree with you and that fits this American scheme of justice? Yes. Thank you so much for jumping in.
For survival, it's just, if you live in Vermont, you live in northern Vermont, it's even more popular, but for hunting and survival and defense on property, you know, it's how long for the police to get to, or if they come to our home, even in Putney, it's, the sheriff can't get here for 20 minutes sometimes, and sometimes they don't come to calls. We have rabid animals running around.
And did everybody hear what, I'm sorry, I forgot your name again.
And I'm not actually using
my guns. Right, right. But you're trying to make that argument. Can you just remind me your name?
Laura.
Laura, sorry. Laura, can you hear what you said? Did everybody hear Laura about what she was saying about living in Vermont and animals and police being far away? Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Is there anything on this page? So if you're making a principle fundamental argument for individual right, where you feel like that right to, and we can either frame it like to be armed or to not be disarmed, fits. Say more. Yeah, cruel and unusual punishment is what Laura's picked.
It's cruel and unusual punishment from somebody that would inflict that upon me if I was on my own. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like I said, safety.
Yeah. Right. Another one, I'll take the second one.
Well, actually, I'd like to do an analogy.
Yeah.
Just after World War II, I believe it was down in Georgia. For lack of a better word, there was a boss hog. I don't really know how to explain it. The town was run by corruption.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And what happened was, a lot of the vets that came home had seen that there was fixed voting. One of them tried to run for office. He kind of got thumped on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the worst of the worst, the worst things you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
These vets actually got armed and defended, as funny as it sounds, the voting booth.
Mm-hmm.
Made sure that the votes got to a reasonable individual who would do the right count.
Mm-hmm.
And that was basically individuals forming a militia to protect the honesty of the town.
Yeah, so and that is so clear, like that was necessary to maintain the American scheme of justice. Yeah, and Laura's just thought of
something. Protesters were recently protected by armed protesters.
Uh-huh, protesters protecting armed protesters. In order to make sure that...
they have their right to free speech.
Free speech, yeah, interesting. Cool, so those are two, great. I said I'd take two, and now I want to hear two, because we're deliberating, in which individual gun rights are not fundamental. So again, we're using this American scheme of justice. Is there an argument somebody wants to make using this to say why they're not individual rights? Because the other option is collective rights. Well, Laura's on us.
Well, the militia. I mean, it's a militia organization, and so that to me nullifies all of it.
Nullifies, I'm going
to
make sure.
Our need for any of this, that we do not need to protect ourselves for this because we're supposed to have a militia. It's not supposed to be individual rights.
Which would right now be like more like the police, but something like the, and why is it that having a collective right, right, state-sanctioned right, is going to be necessary to protect our American scheme of justice? And you had your hand up.
Okay, the only thing I'm saying is all of that is really nice, but that doesn't work in reality. What's happening in reality is that our courts are clogged. We're letting people back out that shouldn't be let back out.
I think you're making the other argument.
So if we don't have the right to defend ourselves, here's a case where we need that right.
So I just need you to turn that into making an argument for a collective right.
There is no
argument for a collective right.
Oh, so can somebody give us one?
It's over the collective.
The thing is, the Germans...
Wait, are you going to make a collective right argument?
No, I'm not going to make a collective right argument because
when the Germans... Okay, you got a collective right argument.
No, you're not.
Okay.
I do.
Okay, awesome.
How many people in this room have driven down the road and seen the sign that says Eisenhower Highway Network?
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Do you know what that means?
Absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What's it mean?
Well, it was developed for, quote, protection. It was a military, the concept of military.
It is a military highway.
Yes.
The federal government at any time can bar every citizen in this country from driving on any major highway.
Can you turn this into a collective right argument?
It's a collective right argument because we would all be, at that point in time, we would be the collective body that was imprisoned by our federal government.
So here's the key piece. I'm just going to reinforce this because I think we got the individual rights argument really well.
That's a collective right
so,
argument.
So that's
everybody
very strong.
In this room. Okay.
So the collective right is actually the state, not just a group of people. It means that the state has the capacity to arm people by license for its own purpose. So this is different than the individual right. The collective right argument is we're going to organize a group of people and they're going to be members of the Vermont State Militia or the Vermont State Police. So this is the argument. I know it's hard to generate great love for the police sometimes, but I'm asking to show a collective right argument for this. Laura's got it.
I think I'm thinking of now of Canadian armed police who are protecting the rights of immigrants to cross their borders and protecting them while they get them to social services, that sort of thing. And they're doing that actually in opposition to at least our government. And they think that collective right is fundamental.
Uh-oh, this is a bad news that if we can only come up with a Canadian example. I want a Vermont argument. Okay. Jack.
I'm thinking of the enforcement of the Supreme Court's decision to integrate schools in the South, which was enforced by National Guard troops and United States Marshals. Would that be in reference to collective utilization of gun rights?
It's kind of good, but there's a certain problem with it in that it was coming from the national government. And so I think even in that one, what happened? Did Eisenhower deputize the National Guard from Arkansas? So what we're looking for is, remember that Federalist, you remember, Bob, the thing that we were looking at, that seesaw? And we had states against the national government. I know that people were a little sad with that because there weren't enough people. But the collective right argument is coming right out of federalism, where you've got the states constraining the national.
What about sanctuary cities?
So sanctuary cities could be a collective right in the sense that somebody is armed, right? We got to make sure this is not just peace and love and kumbaya, mm-hmm. that somebody is armed in order to make sure that happens.
Well, there are actually police departments that are choosing not to cooperate with ICE agents. So right. They are armed.
So exactly. So what's happening, police departments deciding, okay, we're going to do this, they're armed, and they are saying, no, we're going to back off on something that's happening from the federal government. You had your hand up in the green shirt.
I think I was probably was not. I was going to test about something like a national catastrophe or an epidemic, where there might be some designation or deputizing of...
Right. And the minute it becomes national, then we start to lose our subordinate government. So we have a lot of times where the national government brings in the troops for a whole variety of reasons, not just to shoot people, but to do all sorts of important work. So I'm really looking for a collective rights argument, a state that says, this armed group, part of us, is going to protect these. Greg, we'll see if Greg has something else.
Okay, I'll
play. Oh, sorry, first Greg.
The situation of Kent State. National Guard is called out by the government. State Guard, there were no federal officials involved. And their mission was to restrain basically free speech rights of a demonstration on campus at Kent State.
But then they shot students.
And they killed students.
I mean, let's look at our history here, why the collective right argument is so hard to make.
You can make an argument for collective rights as long as you have individual rights. If you have just collective rights, you live in a police state.
That's right.
So as long as they can have their collective rights, but as long as the people have the right to keep and bear arms, the government doesn't get out of control.
Yeah.
Because we are ultimately the arbitrator of what the government does to us. But if we're not armed, we're not the arbitrator. They tell us what to do.
Interesting. So that's another individual right argument. First Ed and then Allison.
Okay. Well, I'll play both sides of the field here.
Oh, good.
The collective right,
yeah.
The overburdened or overbearing government decides to ignore the Constitution, comes in and starts telling the states what to do,
right.
Comes in with troops.
Yeah.
The collective right is the Vermonters standing against the federal government.
And that's exactly what they had in mind.
Yeah.
This notion that this what were they most worried about?
Standing
government. Army.
Yep.
And so the state militias were supposed to be there in order to keep the standing army at bay. So that's absolutely right. Yeah, Allison and then...
So I'm imagining a situation, and I fear that I sort of have to imagine it right at the moment, but where we have a state, which is a constitutional democracy, it's one of the subordinate governments,
mm-hmm.
and what happens in a constitutional democracy is that we deliberate things. So if we're able to deliberate and go through all those different things that you were talking about, where we are able to make legitimate decisions, I don't remember mm-hmm. all the four, but let's say we've made legitimate decisions about how we think things should run, and then we take that collective picture of how we want our state to look, or our town to look, or whatever, and we hand that over to a group of people that I'll call the police,
yeah.
right? So the police now have been deputized, in a sense,
mm-hmm.
to act out what we have deliberated as a large group,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to having a lot of individuals
some of whom maybe talk to one another and some of whom don't, but we don't have that overarching deliberation structure that takes all of us into account. It takes smaller groups into
you
account.
You respect
Right. So the idea is, if you have a state police that is following a deliberative body,
yes,
then we have a collective right that is protecting this. Yeah. But so when you have a state deliberative body that is figuring out, the state meaning Vermont, that kind of state, that is figuring out for itself what is in the best interest of its people, and the police are enforcing that, that's when you have a state collective right against, because it's got to be, and what everybody is saying from the individual rights camp is absolutely true about this Second Amendment is an effort to constrain an overarching federal power. Absolutely right. And collective right was understood as a state level to do that. Now what's interesting, sorry, I'm going to keep pushing because I know we're kind of running out of time, and I do want to open it up to people who haven't spoken yet. So as Jim said, there were two Supreme Court rulings, one in 2008, that was a D.C. case, and the second was in 2010, a Chicago case, in which the Supreme Court said the individual right to bear arms is a fundamental right. So in 2001, a lot of people thought, no, collective right. Everybody understood states as following, as fulfilling that need. Since then, it's now individual rights. And it's pretty interesting what those cases are, but we don't need to go into all the details, but that's and it was a split decision, 5-4. But we're beginning to see the idea that a collective right could even be important. It's starting to, in our imagination, we're having a hard time holding on to that. So then that raises this other question of if being armed is a fundamental right, and I have to tell you, when I started to get ready for this, I'm a little dated. I was in grad school in the 90s. I hadn't heard that many Second Amendment cases, to be quite honest. I knew about the 2001 situation, that one that we talked about, but that was an appeals court. That's not the Supreme Court. So, hey, I learned a lot in preparing to talk to you all about where the Supreme Court has moved. So the 5-4 split decision, 2008 and 2010, it's now incorporated. So that thing that we were talking about has happened for the Second Amendment. It's happened for the First with some cases. You know, it's always these Supreme Court cases. They take our rights and then they incorporate them, meaning that now states have to look at this. So then we have this other issue, though. That means we're now moving into a world where rather than being organized through the states, people's guns are very much an individual right, which is a different kind of world to be in terms of trying to figure out how to reduce gun violence. Yeah, Bob.
First off, I would like to say that the phrase gun violence is incorrect. Guns are not inherently violent. If we have someone who uses a knife and commits a murder, it's a stabbing. It's somebody committed murder. The knife is the tool. A gun is a tool. Baseball bat is a tool. It's misused. So using these terms instills fear in people who don't understand constitutional law, who don't understand gun rights. So that term is bad. If we could use just violence, take the word gun out of it, because we have more beatings and stabbings than we have shootings. Not all of them are fatal, but if you look at the actual statistics, and this, I know you said we weren't looking at statistics and actual facts, but if you do, it plays right into this, and it explains that violence is violence. Whether you're allowed to have a gun or allowed to drive a car, how many DUI number fours do we have in the state of Vermont every year? Well, they're not allowed to, but they do. A law, a right, it's kind of a moot point on if the person, and it goes back to the individual. If the individual has the will to do something that is wrong, harm a fellow man, then whether or not we have a law that affects everybody on certain things, regulating guns, regulating cars, whatever, we see it in England. We mentioned England before about the state saying the people cannot be armed. The British are called subjects. for a reason.
Right.
And it plays into this where...
This term, gun violence, I think that's an important caveat. You're saying, you know, it's not the violence, because there's knife violence and other things. Mm-hmm. I use that term just because, and I didn't put the chart on, because I was thinking, oh my God, I got so many PowerPoint slides. But death by gunshot, suicide, self-inflicted gunshot wound is the lead, am I right, in the state of Vermont, leading cause of death? So it's a very specific kind
of
death.
Well, if you're talking about self-inflicted, we have very high...
It's right.
It's not gun violence. Violence is against another person.
Okay.
If you look at the definition.
Right.
So,
and then there's domestic,
but there's also pills for suicide.
Right. So this is a term, and I hear what you're saying. So,
right.
You know, I'm going to say, like, this this term in itself sort of starts to frame the issue in a way that maybe feels like that's not fair. However, I think that it's pretty clear from the CDC that because looking at suicides, the most effective form of suicide is using a gun. In the state of Vermont, I think most domestic violence homicides, so homicides that come out of domestic violence are gun.
It's so about 50%.
So we've got some statistics in this state that put those two together, domestic violence statistics and suicide statistics, and that's why I'm calling it. But I, you know, I hear what
you're saying. Right, and as you're saying, is it a fundamental right, an individual right?
Mm-hmm.
Does a person who has a history of domestic abuse, they are not federally able to possess a firearm, so they are in violation of existing law. So these are not law-abiding citizens who want to form militia or not.
What you just said actually is so interesting because somebody who used to work in the battered women's movement, it's true. Everything you just said about if you have a restraining order against you, you're not supposed to have a gun. But how many ATF officials do we have in the state?
Two.
Do we have two?
No, we actually have 13.
We have 13 ATF. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, and how many restraining orders do you think we have in the state?
That pass, that go through every year, there's 3,200 a year, roughly, that are requested.
Wow.
Half of those thrown out before they ever get
right.
signed.
Right.
Of the other 1,300 a year, the statistics came out last year, of the 1,300, it was divided equally into uncontested, contested,
right.
and then there's some sort of decision in between.
So thanks for all those statistics, because this sort of shows you, and I'm going to stay with, you know, knowing that there's problems with my question, I'm curious for other people, if being armed is a fundamental right, how do we deal with some pretty clear issues that we have in this state? I could say, we'll get rid of the language that's problematic, but how do we deal with this? Angie had her hand up, and I thought, then Laura, and then Janice. Angie, Laura, Janice.
Well, I feel confused about the word gun, because I feel like there's so many things. So many weapons,
mm-hmm.
and so what's even a gun? Like, when I think of a gun, I think of like a pistol, but at this point, there's just so many weapons that are legal that I don't even know, you know what I'm saying, that the term gun, what does it even mean anymore?
Well, like, the piece I'm going to press on a little bit, though, is it's a fundamental right. Mm-hmm. That's big. It's a fundamental right. You have an AK-47, AR-15. I like to use those kind of words. I feel like maybe I know what you're talking about.
Can we shoot one? Would you like to?
Come on over.
I'll take you out. And then you'll learn something.
I just turned 60, so I'm trying
to. I was an NRA instructor.
And I may be interested in this. I kid you not, but I want to go back to this main issue. I want to go to this really main issue. If it's a fundamental right,
mm-hmm.
how can we even talk?
Well,
I got some other hands up, which is, and Ava, I can do this.
Lady.
So we got Angie, and I pressed on you, Angie. You gotta give me a little bit more. You're telling me you don't know what a gun is. I'm curious, like, when you have a fundamental right to be armed, how do you think we can even talk about it? And I know I'm going to be put pressure on you, and then I'm going to turn to Laura.
Not me. This Laura?
No, you. You had your hand up.
Oh,
it's a fundamental right, and
to bear arms or to have a gun? Like,
to bear arms. A gun is an arm. So even as a domestic violence victim, you should have the right, and you do, to arm yourself.
Yeah.
So it, in an armed society is a polite society.
The violence
is a polite society. When you have this difference in power, criminal comes into a convenience store with a pistol. He knows that clerk cannot have a gun because he'll get his, he'll lose his job. He'll be fired.
So I wanted to see, again, because what Bob just said, actually, a Texas graduate student put it in the New York Times. So what Bob is saying is absolutely right. He said an armed society is a polite society. So this New York Times Texas graduate student is now able, because Texas allows you to have, I think, concealed carry on campus, mm-hmm. three C's, pretty easy to remember. And she wrote this whole piece of, I was attacked once, I'm not going to be attacked again, I'm in night school, I have to walk from my school building to my car all by myself, and since I got a Glock, I don't know, she feels better, mm-hmm. right? Because she feels like a little more like an armed prophet than an unarmed prophet. So anyway, so I'm not going against the fundamental right, I'm just trying to figure out how do we deal with the issues when it's too much. I'm not debating the rights. Laura.
Wow. I'm thinking of my sister-in-law, who was abducted from her home by an armed individual. And her will, mm-hmm. her autonomy, mm-hmm. her life, was at stake. Mm-hmm. And she was a mother and an animal owner and would never have had guns around. She was abducted by a stalker of a woman she had been trying to protect. And she had been trying to get one of these orders that would preclude his having a gun. She was missing for 10 days and then was discovered, it was discovered that she had been incinerated.
Oh, wow.
And what happened in those 10 days? She was definitely an unarmed prophet, mm-hmm. born on the 4th of July.
Wow.
A bold and courageous woman, not yet 50, and with three grown children. And I see the imbalance of coercive power so exaggerated, or, you know, tipped by the presence of a gun. You know, I've been robbed with by an index finger in Central Park and lived to tell about it. But you ask a very good question. And this individual was not in possession of a gun legally. I don't know if I should add this, but there were other strange tools of death in his pickup truck, like a garrote. But a gun is awfully quick. But anyway, I don't know. I'm just giving a personal experience. That affected a lot of lives, as does suicide.
Right, that's part of what we've got here, Janet.
So I'm not answering this question. My question comes off of something Jim said a while ago. Very different world than when the Constitution was written. And in those days, certainly everybody could have been armed, and the government would have felt threatened. We have a pretty armed society right now, mm-hmm. And even if everybody was armed, mm-hmm. I still don't see today how that's going to hold our government at bay, mm-hmm. with the arsenal that they have. I mean, since Kent, I felt like that since Kent State, you know. And so, I mean, that to me kind of nullifies this whole thing. It would be a different conversation than the original amendment, where you're talking about restraining this power of the government. It's hard for me to make the leap to where we are today without answering that question.
Right.
Because every man and woman in this country could have an arsenal, and they still would not be able to protect themselves from the United States.
Yes, sir. Only 3%.
Only 3% of the colonialists
overthrew the most powerful army in the world at the time, which was the British government.
And do you think that would happen today?
Listen, all us ex-military people are not going to stand for our government taking us over.
So I got a trick question. I got a trick question.
And another thing, when this country was formed, people were abducted all the time by the Indians. I can recount all the stories of the tribes that came down in here and killed people. And
they don't invite him again. I didn't invite him. It's on our page.
So here we go. This is like a hard thing to talk about. And so just like a little moment, I know we're about running out of time, and you may feel like, oh, what is she doing to us? Well, I want you to kind of like just take a little bit of stock about how difficult this conversation is. This is a really difficult conversation, and people feel very, very strongly about it. And because it's about guns, it is going to be inherently, Bob's point well taken, whenever we talk about guns, we're also going to be talking about violence. And as human beings, it turns out we are very subject to violence. Look at how I'm not a turtle. I got this whole belly here. If I was a turtle, maybe I wouldn't be so worried. But as a species, think about how vulnerable we are. We are not hedgehogs. We're not bears. So when we talk about things like this, we're talking about violence at the exact same time, and it's in our heads. So this is a super hard thing to talk about. And yet, the whole point of the series is, can we actually talk about our rights? Can we really deliberate them? And I got all the hands up, and I'm not going to call on anybody, because here's what I need to answer to before we break off for the evening.
I have an answer for this question.
Oh, you have an answer?
Yes.
Okay. How can states reduce gun violence through mental health?
Yes.
So that could be
exactly,
you know, rather than reduce, because we can't take away a fundamental right easily. That's just the nature of things. So maybe mental health. And you had your hand up too.
I just wanted to give you a story of something that happened to me. I was married, 22 years old. My husband works nights. He had a crazy ex. They had a kid together. She got remarried. The guy murdered her new husband, murdered his father, buried him in the basement on Long Island. We had all the proof. He was 17 and a half when he did it. New York tried him as a youth. He got out when he was 18 years old. He came slamming on our door, knowing that my husband was working, telling me he's going to kill us, me and my two young kids, because he was pissed off that we went to court for visitation. The only thing that stopped him, we lived on top of Woodford Mountain, 40 minutes from the police, is a 12-gauge pump.
That sound.
And he left. Yeah. That's the only thing that I believe to this day on my life, that's the only thing that saved my kids and me.
Yeah, that sound. I totally get that. Yeah. I have this. Wow.
You want to empower a woman? That's how you do it.
It's an equalizer. It really is.
So, you know, you may have answered the question, Laura and...
Annette.
No fingers. That's okay. So Laura Campbell and Annette may have answered this question, but this is the big one. Like, what information do you need to actually deliberate? Second Amendment. Some people say begin with first person narratives. Don't begin with rights. Don't begin with the way I started the evening, looking at the Second Amendment. Because then people get into their rights. You can't have my rights, you can't take my rights. But the way, and we do, I think, have an issue in this country that we have to address in terms of violence, perhaps. I would feel that way, being not a hedgehog or a turtle. And so to have these stories can be a very powerful way to begin a deliberation. All of a sudden, I don't know, for me, it certainly felt like, wow, yeah.
I don't have an answer yet, but I have a willingness to listen. And when we sometimes just talk on the level of rights, we shut each other down. And we never hear these really important stories that could complicate things so that maybe you think about things differently, right? And if we can hear our stories more, then we're in a position maybe we can start to deliberate more. It's not going to be easy. This is a big amendment. It is now an individual right. So some ways of arguing we may be able to change if we feel strongly about it, to go back to the states operating against the national government in a way that provides a check. However, the truth of the matter is we move so much as Americans, we do not have the same devotion to our states that we used to have. So the idea of states really being this attachment, this first attachment against the federal government, that's not happening in this century.
If I may. One thing that has changed over the last 40 years is the states have given back the rights that they have taken from their citizens. More people carry in this country. Every year, Connecticut has an all-time high. They are ranked very well. They're very safe. Vermont is number one. Maine is number two. New Hampshire's number four. Virginia's number three. Mm-hmm. So the New England states are very safe. Massachusetts, which has very strict laws against your rights, comes in at 32nd place. The 32nd state is out of 50. That's not very good. What the states have done over the last 15, 20 years, since 2003 actually, since Alaska went constitutional carry, states have gotten safer. The states who have given their states their citizens back their rights, and this goes even to Illinois, which is notorious with Chicago. These states have taken the...
Can you answer the third question?
This.
Yeah.
Facts.
So
let's start with facts. Crime has decreased 40% over the last 20 years.
And again, we're not looking for the facts. Mm-hmm. But so for Bob, it's fact. I was making a push for the stories. And yes, in the back.
My name is Jim. Just one more on that would be, again, to look at what exactly the definitions of the entire statement of the First and Second Amendment mean. The people in both of those are the same people.
So you want everybody to spend more time with this.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's just something that a lot of people liberally define the First Amendment and very conservatively define the Second Amendment, regardless of the RD at the end of their name.
Right.
And that's what really makes the problem for me, looking at it as an individual in the state of Vermont, in the United States of America, saying, I have an individual right. It says so in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. I am the people. I'm not the militia, nor would I really be the militia. It was 14 to 45 at that time, all able-bodied males.
So
I'm not that anymore.
Sorry to cut you off. I'm just running out of time. So we've got facts, stories, Constitution. Is there any other thing for somebody, perhaps if you haven't spoken, that you feel would be useful for you in order to deliberate about the Second Amendment?
I don't know, but I grew up around guns. I hunted when I was 10 years old, on my own, with a gun. And then somewhere along the way at 76, AK-47, I'd never seen, you couldn't eat a squirrel that was killed by a woman. I don't know what the hell an AK-47 is doing in anybody's dooryard. And I was raised and used guns, and we have them in my family. But there's something gone awry
here. Can I push on you, Eva? So what do you mean, Eva?
I'd like to see some regulations on guns, who owns them, and whatever, because I hear these stories all the time. You know, that scares me.
Can we go back
to McDonald versus Chicago?
Facts, stories, Constitution, regulation. Wow, that's going to be interesting. Regulation. Yeah.
Could we go back to McDonald versus Chicago?
You posed that question. It comes down to when this Constitution was written, there was a death penalty. This country has basically abolished the death penalty. Now it has come down to dollars and cents. Almost every few months you hear about how much money it costs to keep a person incarcerated in the state of Vermont or out of the state of Vermont. To stop the violence, you have to punish the criminal. Mm-hmm. The taxpayers of this country cannot afford to enforce the laws that are on the book to incarcerate the number of criminals that are out there.
So this is an argument, but I'm looking for what do people need? And maybe we're going to say, this would be nice, right, because we're wrapping up. Maybe we just need this. Here we are. This is another group, Putney Library. Maybe we just need to come together. For the most part, and I was pushing people, reasons must be given. I know sometimes, you know, tempers would flare, and but people were, for the most part, actually giving some reasons, so I'm feeling pretty happy about that. And if you didn't, I pressed on you. There was information provided. Not everybody may have agreed with the reasoning behind the information, but hey, I appreciate the fact that information was provided. We can't make any decisions tonight. Clearly, this is going to be way too contentious. And did anybody, okay, this is maybe you don't want to say it, but my hope is that somebody at least learned something about their neighbors tonight, that humanized their neighbors. And if we got a little closer to that, I'm going to say that's pretty good. So anyway, thank you very much, everybody, for coming out. We talked about the Second Amendment. Very much appreciate it. And next month, we're doing privacy, the Fourth Amendment.